This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stopping the NYPD's stop and frisk. More than 700,000, according to the NYPD documentation, predominantly African Americans and Latinos, have been profiled for stops and frisks as a result of what is now referred to as the new Jim Crow policies of policing.
Policing that inflicts state terror on communities of color. But in response to the increasing criminalization of communities of color is a burgeoning movement prepared to stop and frisk, as they say no to the new Jim Crow. First, we'll hear from Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, as she spoke at Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church.
The suffering have not been driving the explosion of our prisons. So what has? The war on drugs and the Get Tough movement, the wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. What has changed dramatically is not so much crime, but what gets defined as crime and how we respond to it. And nothing has contributed more to this harsh response than the war on drugs. Drug convictions alone accounted for two-thirds of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. But the drug war, not by accident, has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color. Even though studies have consistently shown people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Plenty of drug dealing happens in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. A white kid living in rural Kansas doesn't drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his cocaine. He gets it most likely from someone of his own race down the road. In fact, where significant differences in the survey data appear frequently suggest that white youth are more likely to engage in illegal drug dealing than black youth. But that's not what you would get by taking a peek inside our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been African American. Many people, when they see the data, they're stunned, and they say, yeah, that's awful. But still, we need to be waging a drug war in those ghetto communities, because that's where the violent offenders can be found. That's where the drug kingpins can be found. They say it makes sense to wage the drug war in the ghetto communities because we have to get tough with them. That's where the violence is. Indeed, in my experience, most people seem to imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine and the related violence. But it's not true. President Ronald Reagan declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was on the decline, not on the rise. He declared the drug war before, not after, crack became a media sensation and was ravaging inner city communities. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, and less than 3% of the American population identified drugs as the nation's most pressing concern. So why declare a drug war at a time when drug crime is declining and the American population isn't much concerned about drugs? The answer is that from the outset, the drug war has relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction or drug abuse, and nearly everything to do with politics, racial politics. The war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working-class whites in the South who were resentful of, fearful of, anxious about many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group of people not so suddenly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal Coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. In fact, in the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he explained strategy this way, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not adhering to," end quote. Well, they did. Where do we go from here? Those of us in the civil rights community, we've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch.
Right.
Yeah. Many of us, myself included, fighting for affirmative action, fighting to cling to the gains of the past, millions of people rounded up, branded criminals and felons, stripped of the very rights people gave their lives for. So what do we do? Over the last few decades, $1 trillion has been spent waging the drug war. Funds that have been used for education in our communities, for job creation, for our collective well-being. Instead, those dollars have been used for the destruction of so many of our families, our communities, our dreams. What do we do? Nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. Reform is enough. If you think we can tinker with this machine and then get it right, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement kicked off, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. This system is now so deeply rooted in our political and economic structure that it isn't just going to fade away. It's not going to just fade away without a major social upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. Out loud that we as a nation have managed to rebirth a cat-like system in the United States. And we've got to be willing to tell this truth in our churches, in our schools, in our community centers. Because if we fail to really wake up, we will never build the kind of movement that is necessary to end this system. But even that is not enough. Consciousness raising is not enough. We've also got to be willing to build an underground railroad for the people returning home from prison. People who are struggling, striving to make a true break for freedom have got to be supported, have got to be welcomed with open arms, with love. There are people doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses. No other country in the world does such a thing. We've got to stop this us versus them. The criminals are someone who's not us. And instead say, there, but for the grace of God, go I. All of us are sinners. All of us have made mistakes, done wrong. And all of us need to be given second and third and fourth chances, because none of us has made only one mistake in our lives. So we must support those returning home and the families who are struggling to survive in the era of mass incarceration, but we've also got to be willing to work for an end to this system itself. And that means ending the war on drugs once and for all. It means abolishing all of these laws that authorize legal discrimination against people in employment, housing, access to public benefits, denying them basic human rights to work and to shelter and to food. And last but not least, we've got to shift from a purely punitive approach to dealing with violence in our community to a rehabilitative and a restorative approach to violence in our community. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've got to end mandatory minimum sentences and stop and frisk practices and federal funding for the sheer numbers of drug arrests. We've got a lot of work to do. Must be born, a movement that respects and honors the dignity and humanity of all people. And this has got to be a multiracial movement, a multi-ethnic movement, because although this war on drugs was born with black folks in mind, it is a war that has destroyed the lives of people and communities of all colors. And the same divisive racial politics that birthed mass incarceration is now being played out with immigrants as the target. And prison building aimed at housing suspected immigrants is now underway in the United States. So we've got to connect the dots and build a multiracial movement, multi-ethnic movement on behalf of all of us. But before this movement can even get underway, a great awakening is required. We've got to awaken from this colorblind slumber that we've been in to the realities of race in America. And we've got to be willing to embrace those labeled criminals. Not necessarily all their behavior, but them, their humanness. For it has been the refusal and failure to recognize the dignity and humanity of all people that has been the sturdy foundation for every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It's our task to end not just mass incarceration, but to end this history and cycle of caste in America.
Michelle Alexander to a standing ovation at Abyssinians Baptist Church. We now bring you the sound from a rally and press conference in front of the Manhattan Criminal Court in support of Mary Black, whose son was arrested when he said no to stop and frisk.
We'll hear from parents Mary Black and Juanita Rivera, Letitia James, City Council member, and Occupy Wall Streeter Jamel Mims.
We head to the sound.
No more stop and frisk! No more stop and frisk!
We are in front of 100 Center Street, the criminal court in Manhattan. Jamel, this is one of a number of stop and frisk activities that I've certainly seen you at. You've been arrested yourself in stop and frisk. Why are these important issues to you?
Well, yeah, actually, in fact, coming right off of a presentation of Michelle's new paperback release of The New Jim Crow, she really ran into how the civil rights movement of old has had a huge letdown in letting the system of mass incarceration and this new caste system, this new underclass of repeatedly incarcerated or otherwise stop and frisk black and Latino youth, and letting this new underclass form. And that we were out of the 32nd precincts really drawing from the community and telling the stories of the community and people who have been repeatedly harassed by police there and who have come to gain some clarity on the actual role of the police in their neighborhoods and in their society. So in contextualizing it and the new Jim Crow, I've been a part of this action and have gotten arrested and have done civil disobedience, similar to the way that the freedom riders and the freedom fighters challenged the old Jim Crow with civil disobedience. Simple things like stepping into a lunch counter that were deemed illegal to do so with people of different races. Now we go out and stop the illegal actions of the NYPD through stop and frisk, through shutting these precincts down, gaining awareness around the issue altogether. This is a human rights issue of our time right now.
Why is there this targeting of young, primarily black and Latinos in the urban areas?
What you see is a total narrative framed around ideas of safety and around ideas of keeping the community safe, keeping them away from criminals or people that look like or resemble criminals. This conversation totally ignores the overt criminalization of those youth and really where the source comes from. A lot of this policy actually precedes any of the justification for it. You have things like the war on drugs preceding the introduction of crack cocaine and mass amounts of drugs being such a ubiquitous thing in black and underclass communities. The war on drugs actually preceded that. You have what is really the counterinsurgency before the insurgency. This system learned a lot in the 60s and 70s from the conditions of black and Latinos and their struggle and them coming up and knowing that within those people are the seeds of making the system a lot more egalitarian and actually undoing it. And that's a very threatening thing. That's very threatening overall. So you have policies like stop and frisk that overtly target specific populations, as well as a lot of political ramifications as far as bringing in a largely white and middle class poor vote from swing states. You know, all the language of being tough on crime that was kind of developed during the Clinton administration. So there's a lot of political undercurrents, but the main reason is this idea of counterinsurgency before the insurgency and this thing that has stemmed from the war on drugs that Nixon began with. The problem is the blacks. They just need to find a way to do something about it without being overt about saying that. And then a lot of racially coded language that was pushed through. So
people should get involved who have a little more leeway to get involved, people who might not otherwise get involved with the criminal justice system. And I guess since in our society, most people who get involved in the criminal justice system or people of color, it seems like white people have a lot more options and could maybe use some of their privilege to draw attention to a serious emergency issue.
What do you mean privilege?
Just that in New York City, in my experience, white people aren't subject to this policy. They say that over 10% of the people who are stopped and frisked are white, but honestly, I feel like that's, if they're lying about anything, they're lying about that, because I have never seen a white person stop and frisk in New York City.
And we're speaking with Jamal from Occupy Wall Street. And you are?
Benita Rivera. I'm the co-founder of the Mother's Agenda New York, also known as The Many.
Why did you come down here to support Mary Black and to raise up this issue of stopping, stop and frisk?
Because Mary Black's son is my son. All of us mothers need to just put our foot down and say, it's enough. It is absolutely enough. This fear and horrific terrorizing and traumatizing of our children and what we feel in our guts every time they leave our purview, until they come home safely and without incident, this is horrendous. It should not be happening in New York City. Children, young men, our brothers, our husbands, our sons, our fathers should be able to walk while black, while Latino, in all areas of New York City. They have not committed a crime because of the color of their skin. And this racial profiling of our humanity is unacceptable. And the mothers in this city need to rise up and say so.
Thank you.
Everybody, can we have our attention on Mary Black, please?
I want to thank each and every one of y'all for coming out and supporting me. This was a day that I hoped that I didn't have to endure. Unfortunately, I'm here because of an act that is unjust, because my son is not a criminal. He's a very good kid. He's caught up in a policy that the New York City Police Department is enacting, and that's the stop and frisk. One day, I was home. I had just came home from school, and he had just left out the house. He was gone no longer than about 5 minutes. My bell rung, and it was a neighbor telling me that the cops had my son up against the wall. Now, he was on his way to the gym at that moment, so I run downstairs. I had to go downstairs with just my robe and my socks, and it was a cold day. And I seen him handcuffed in the back of the police car. I know a lot of you probably can't relate to it, but as a mother, when you see your child being treated as a criminal, when you know that you teach him morals, values, and standards and ways to carry on to lead a productive life, at that moment, all of that went out the door. Because when I approached the officer and I asked him, what did my son do, or could I see him? I was told no. I would have to go to the precinct. When I did get to the precinct, I asked him, what did he do? Why was he arrested? Why was he in handcuffs? The response to me was, he talked too much. So now, as a mother, I had to beg, and I asked him to please just think of what I'm doing, because I'm trying to raise him to be a good kid. Go to school, get your education, and do what you need to do in life. At that moment, I broke down, and I told him, he's a good kid. Just give me a chance. Don't arrest him. So he agreed to just give him a desk appearance and not send him to central booking. But what I'm saying is that that moment should have never occurred. And I, being a mother, have to stand out and say, you have to look at me, because I am someone. My child is someone. He is not a criminal. Whatever policy they have has to be looked at and asked, do people like myself and many others of y'all that's standing around deserve for our children to be treated this way? And that's why I'm here this morning, to let the world know that if anyone is experiencing like I'm experiencing, the way we're going to get our voice heard is by speaking up. And if we don't speak up, they're going to look at it. This is what we can do. Because nobody's going to say anything. I just want to let everybody know that I'm here this morning, and really, I'm a working mom. His father's a working father. We should not be here today. This is a really totally unnecessary day for both of us. But like I said, you know, it was a moment that nobody should have to go through. And the way that he was treated, I really felt bad, because when you see your child in a police car, you know that's your child. But once them handcuffs go on, you have no say-so over your child. That was a hurting moment for me, because it was nothing that I could do. So I just want a lot of us to come out, to speak up, to do something about this, because this really has to stop, because it affects people's lives. It affects children's lives. So that's one of the reasons why I'm doing what I need to do. So, you know, yeah. And unfortunately, another point I want to make is that the reason that I'm so adamant about it now is because in a 5-month period, my son had 4 summonses and 1 arrest. And that's one of the reasons why I'm adamant about doing something about this. Because when you look at it, 5 months, 4 summonses and 1 arrest, something is wrong with that picture. I'm a mother that keeps very close tab on their child. He doesn't run from here, there, all over the place. This was done in a 2-block radius from home. Now you ask yourself, what's wrong with that? And when he got arrested. He was up against the wall right across the street from where I live. Just left out the house 5 minutes. So I just want everyone to know that we have to do something. As a mother, I'm here to ask anyone that experienced or even can feel the pain that I felt or that I still feel to please come forward and just help me get an agenda across that something has to be done, because we should not be terrorized or feel like we are being terrorized, because I can't rest in my home. When my son go out the door, I am literally scared that he won't come back home. I'm constantly calling him, texting him, asking him where is he. So now I know his freedom is gone as well as mine, because I can't rest. I can't even get undressed if he's not in the house, because I don't know when that moment will come again. That's one of the reasons I just want to let everybody know the experience that I experienced, and I know that I really shouldn't have to go through that. Me and his father should never, ever have to endure someone telling us that our son is being up against the wall. Why? Because I know he's a good kid, very good kid, because that's the way we teach him. And I just want to thank everybody for coming out and supporting me this morning. Thank you.
My name is Letitia James, and I'm a member of the New York City Council. And yesterday, we celebrated Dr. King's birthday, and the mayor attended several events. And based on media reports, at 2 events, one in Brooklyn and one in Harlem, he was jeered. He was primarily jeered because the policies related to stop and frisk, because Police Commissioner Kelly, unfortunately, does not recognize that we have a problem in New York City. Reality is that 1 out of every 2 African-American young male child will be stopped and frisked in their life. That is absolutely unconscionable and should be a shock to anyone who has a conscience. Quite simply, the ends does not justify the means. And the means, unfortunately, is not resulting in any reduction in crime. But what it is producing is the criminalization of an entire generation. In my district in Brooklyn this past summer, a number of college kids came home, and most of them were stopped and frisked as they went out. A majority of them were young college kids who just came home for the summer in what has been somewhat described as a working class, middle class community. And their only crime was that they were young and black and male. And that really should not be the case in New York City. And the law basically says that the only reason you should stop and frisk someone is based upon some sort of objective criteria. Because you can observe perhaps a gun, there's some sort of indicia that in fact they are carrying a gun, or that they pose a threat to someone, not based on the fact that they are young, black, and male. And crime in a certain community also, courts have said, is not a basis for stopping and frisking anyone. which is illegal, unconstitutional, abusive, and in violation of the rights of all of us. And so we are here today because if they can come after young black males, they can come after all of us. And we do not want to live in a society where the only basis for the police officers abusing their authorities is because you're young, black, and male. So we urge the mayor to really examine these policies. As someone who examined these policies when I was in the Assistant Attorney General's office, there's a number of recommendations and they have not been implemented. And that was under former Attorney General Spitzer. And nothing has been done. Nothing. And these abuses continue. And unfortunately, they abuse the system by arresting individuals for disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, obstructing governmental administration. All of these subjective crimes, which unfortunately have been used to violate the rights of young black men and also to justify their arrest. We, as good conscious individuals of consciousness, we need to stand up. And we need to say to the mayor of the city of New York and to Police Commissioner Kelly, you need to cease and desist and respect the rights of all individuals. This would not be happening in neighborhoods that do not look like mine. And so we should not live in a world, particularly, again, after we celebrated Dr. King and after, again, Mayor Michael Bloomberg took to the podium and said we should respect Dr. King and live out his legacy and his dream, not engage in these policies which are clearly based on race. And lastly, my name is Letitia James, and I'm a member of the New York City Council and a member of the Progressive Caucus of the City Council. And I never want to hold any more mothers, and I never want to get any calls as I do in the middle of the night saying, Tish, they've arrested my child. I need you. Those are some of the worst calls, and unfortunately, I get them all too often. In fact, most elected officials of color get them, and that really should not be the case in the city of New York. Mayor Bloomberg, put a stop to the stop and frisk practices in the city of New York. Honor Dr. King by examining these policies and stopping them immediately. Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.